To actually do a brief review of thermal history of the universe. So part B is brief thermal history of course doesn't mean that the thermal history is brief. It means that I will discuss it briefly. Okay, and so just to make sure, as the time go, well, after the Big Bang, you know, time starts clicking, and you can trade time for, let's say, how big the universe is. So for the scale factor, there is a unique relation between A and T, and similarly, there is unique relation between A and Z, the redshift, which you observe of galaxies, and so on. So you can always sort of exchange these parameters. Temperature of, and you can also exchange it for the temperature of the cosmic microwave background. So of the cosmic radiation decreases as the universe expands. And basically, you have so many parameters you can choose from to describe at what time this is happening or at what temperature this is happening. So you can change the scale factor with the temperature. You can change it with, let's say, the redshift, which you observe. Or you can change it with time. So all these parameters, basically, there are relations in between them. So you can specify one of them, and then you know all the others. So just an example. So if you have T over T0, I've shown you that this is A over A0 over A. So this is inversely proportional. And this is, let's say, 1 plus Z, where Z is your redshift. Or this is omega over omega 0. And so on. So we have relations like these, and so you can always relate these things. And of course, the precise relation in between these quantities, it depends on the matter content of the universe. So this will be slightly different if you are in era which is dominated by radiation, or if you are in era which is dominated by matter, and so on. So specifically, if I'm interested in between this A and T relation, or between T and T relation, so I need to specify that matter content. So specifically for radiation, yeah, then you have a beautiful relation between the temperature and the time. And so the temperature measured in MeVs is basically 1 divided by T measured in seconds. So you can estimate, you know, 1 second after the Big Bang, what the temperature of the universe was. Okay, so it's just, oh, it's just like 0.01, like of the order of unity. Okay. And so that's why if you see these beautiful diagrams about the evolution of the universe, people sometimes use T, sometimes use energy, sometimes use temperature, and so on. So I'll give you time and the energy. Okay, so let me start with where we are now. So whenever I talk about T, it will be in seconds, and then the energy will be in different units. So at this point, we are at something like 10 to the 16 seconds after the Big Bang. And so we know that there are galaxies and stars and blah, blah, blah. And so these things were formed by gravitational instabilities, formed by gravitational collapse, formed by gravitational stabilities, And so, of course, you have to have some initial inhomogeneity so that this starts happening. So it's from small initial inhomogeneities. So now you might think this is well understood era, but it's not really. So there's still very active ongoing research going here. So if you are interested, you may do your research on structure formation. And even if you do it using Newtonian gravity, it's still a very difficult and nonlinear problem. So you have to write a computer program and so on. So it's difficult. Also, you may want to understand the nature of dark matter and dark energy if you want. It's also in this era, right? So now let's move back in time. So now we are 10 to the 12th. And that's basically the time where the cosmic microwave background was released. Radiation was released. So now, basically, three things happen at this time. And they are usually united to one because they happen very, very close. But we will discuss it a little bit probably on Monday. But what happens is, first, you have like a combination. That means that you form neutral atoms so you have, before that you have just, let's say, helium plus plus, and then after this period actually it recombines with your electrons and you form a neutral helium. So what is really more important than helium is the hydrogen. So E minus plus E plus, and you form a neutral hydrogen. Another event which happens is that, which happens slightly after this actually, is that the photons completely decouple. So you have hydrogen, but also you release some photons here. So these photons are sort of coupled because of these reactions, but when this ceases, then the photons decouple. So photon decoupling. So if photons cannot find any more electrons which they would bump into, then they sort of are free to roam. And that's where you have the surface of last scattering. And then after that, actually, the universe is transparent for radiation. Okay. And so just to say here that helium also recombines, for example. But it recombines actually slightly earlier than this. So it combines earlier. So it's not such a dramatic event because you still have a plasma after a combination of helium. So still universe is not transparent. There's still universe is opaque. So universe. Still opaque. Okay. So now we are 10 to 11. 10 to 11. So nothing really interesting happens except that now the radiation energy density is equal to the matter energy density. So radiation equals to matter equality. So everything which happens after this time is our matter-dominated era or lambda-dominated era. Everything which happens before is sort of like radiation-dominated era. Okay. So now we make a big jump, and we go all the way to 3 minutes. So 3 minutes. And that's 0.1 MeV. Okay, 0.1 MeV. And what happens here, and we will discuss it in detail today, hopefully, is that Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And nucleosynthesis, that means that actually you fuse your nuclei. So you form helium plus plus, and then you form other elements like lithium and beryllium and stuff like that. Okay. So. Okay. We keep going. So that's our timeline. So now we are about 6 seconds, which is 0.5 MeV. And of course, that's the mass of the electron, something like that. So at this point, electrons annihilate this positrons. So E minus E plus annihilation. And as a result, you get only few electrons per number of gamma and per number of photons here. So you have just one electron in 10 to the 9 photons. What also happens is that as you actually annihilate these things, that you pump the energy into the photons. And as you pump the energy into the photons, actually the temperature of the photons slightly increases. Okay, and so for this reason, actually the temperature of the photons is bigger than the temperature of the neutrinos, which decouple slightly earlier. Okay. So now we are at 1 second. That's the MeV. This is the time where actually neutrino decouple. Decoupling. Okay. So basically, electroweak interactions are not strong enough. Well, the frequency of them, the rate is not so huge. So neutrinos completely decouple from all the matter. And as one of the consequences, which is very important, is that neutrinos play a role in changing neutrons to protons. And so on. So after you decouple neutrinos, the ratio of neutrons to protons freezes out. Okay, so neutron to proton ratio freezes out. And of course, this is very important for your nucleosynthesis because the number of neutrons which survive for your nucleosynthesis tell you how much helium you can fuse and so on, right? So this thing actually will be important for nucleosynthesis. Okay. So now there is an unknown time when dark matter freezes out. And you know, you can imagine a model which we discussed yesterday, for example. Freezes out. Then you have 10 to minus 5 seconds, which is something like 150 MeV. And that will be the QCD phase transition. So basically, you don't have free quarks anymore, just form baryons and stuff like that. Then you have 10 to minus 10, you have, which is 100 GeV. That's our Higgs, right? So it's the electroweak phase transition. So basically now your gauge bosons become massive due to the Higgs mechanism. And of course, the reaction rates have to react on that. So they will change. Okay. From middle. Okay, then I have 10 to the 14 seconds, and which is something like 10 TeV. Okay, so you know, all the way up to here, we can access that by our accelerator, by LHC, right? So all the way up to here, it's accessible. Right. See, and you know, everything up to here is sort of like well understood physics, right? So you have standard model, which is verified by all the experiments we have, right? So all the way up to here, you understand everything. And then is a huge gap where you don't understand anything, and then is a big bang here. Okay, there's a big bang here. And then there's 10 to minus 43 seconds, which is the Planck scale. So it's 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay. Where, of course, nobody understands anything. So you quantum gravity should play the role. This is very speculative. But in between, it's also very speculative, right? So what's happening in between 10 to minus 14 and 10 to minus 43? Well, it's a question mark here. But what must have happened is something like baryogenesis, and you need to explain, for example, there, why the number of particles and antiparticles wasn't equal. Okay, so what happens here is, I'll just put it here, it's baryogenesis. Another speculation, almost confirmed, is the inflation might have happened here. You might have created some interesting objects, like, let's say, topological defects. For example, that's when cosmic strings would be created, or monopoles and stuff like that, strings. And also at 10 to the 16, you perhaps have gut theories, grand unified theories. But all this is sort of like speculative. But up to 10 to the 14, you understand everything. Questions? I think it would happen around this gut scale, so 10 to the 16 GeV. Probably, maybe. Okay. So that's the brief history of the universe. So now let me discuss a little bit more. So we will discuss some of the things. So we will not completely discuss anything out here. But discuss a little bit the neutrino decoupling, and I think annihilation will be probably your homework. I am not sure yet. And then we will discuss today Big Bang nuclear synthesis, and then probably on Monday we discuss CMB and this recombination and stuff like that, and then Kurt will discuss structure formation a little bit. So you know, in the end of this course, you should understand some of these things here. So let me do today Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And I will really not do any difficult calculations. I'll just do back of the envelope calculation as Gamow would do, or Fermi would do, or whatever. So now, what is this about? Is that if you draw a periodic table, I don't know, something like this. And then you start with the hydrogen here, and then you have the helium here, and there's some strange things here as well. But anyway, what is important is you have a bunch of elements, and there are, I don't know, 150 or 200 elements. But if you look at the universe as a whole, then actually the universe is composed only of two elements. It's the hydrogen and it's the helium. And everything else is just tiny little seasoning. So you have only small abundance of these things. So by mass, universe is composed of 75% of the hydrogen and 25% of helium. And then everything else is just really, really small things. And so now, interesting question is, when and where all these things were produced, right? Whether you could, where you can fuse your helium, where you can produce iron, where you can produce other things. And so people started answering these questions in 50s, in the middle of 20th century. So when and where? And you know, there are clever people like Bethe and Fermi and Fowler and Gamow and Hoyle, and these people are really interested in these things. And at the time, it was just invent of quantum field theory, so they didn't really know quantum field theory. They didn't know anything. So, but they had these back of the envelope calculations, and they could basically quantitatively estimate, or at least qualitatively, but usually quantitatively as well, what's happening there. Okay, so now one thing they knew is that the iron is actually the most thermodynamically stable element . That means that as long as you fuse your things all the way up to iron here, then you can make them thermodynamically. It's actually energetically favorable to go to create these elements. Okay, so up to this, yes, we can cook these elements. Cook our elements in our kitchen, in the pot. So in the centers of the stars. So that will be a chapter on its own. So I'm not going to discuss it at all. But what it means is that you can basically, thermodynamics works in your favor, and the process which allows that is the fusion, right? Okay, so that's fine. So we can make all the elements up all the way up to iron, but what about the heavier elements? So heavier elements actually wouldn't be thermodynamically favorable. So they can be produced only in something where actually thermodynamics does not work. So you cannot be in equilibrium. So there must be some, you know, violent things and so shocks. Okay. So heavy elements were produced in some violent processes. So produced by shocks. So you cannot have thermodynamic equilibrium. So for example, supernova explosion. Okay, so this seems that this is really the prescription how you can explain all the elements. But actually, it's not really true, because as I will show you in a minute, if this was the only way how you can, for example, make helium, then the abundance of helium would be much, much smaller than 25%. So that was actually a big thing, and it was a big support for the Big Bang theory. Okay, so cannot explain the abundance of light elements, of lighter elements, something like helium, lithium, beryllium, and so on. So if you actually use this thing, which I'll show just now, then you wouldn't get 25% of helium, for example. So to show this, I'll really consider just the simplest thing, which is the helium. So now you know that the binding energy of helium is something like 28 MeV. So binding energy is precisely the energy which you would get when you fuse one helium. So binding energy is like 28 MeV. Which means that if I fuse one helium, so one helium, well, it has basically like four baryons. It has two protons, two neutrons. So if you fuse one helium, what you get, so one helium, the energy which is released is 7 MeV. Which is 10 to the minus 5 erg per baryon. That's come from the fact that you have four baryons there. Okay, so far so good. 28 divided by 4 is 7. So now let's say that we want to really explain this 25%. So if 1/4 of baryons fused into helium in stars, so now this would have to happen during the age of our universe, right? So let's say during last 10 to the 10 years, which is 3 times 10 to the 17 seconds, so that we have these strange units. Okay. Then one thing which actually astrophysicists can measure is the luminosity to mass ratio. Okay, so how much light you get from the mass in the universe? Okay, so then luminosity to mass ratio which is the luminosity over m of the baryons. Okay, so now we say 1/4. And then the luminosity is energy per time. So it's 10 to the minus 5 erg per that time, which is 3 times 10 to the 17 seconds. And then, so this is how much energy is released per baryon with respect to the mass of the baryon. So with respect to the mass of the proton, which is 1.7 times 10 to the minus 24 gram. So this is the mass of the baryon, let's say proton. This is all very approximate. So now if you calculate this thing here, what you find out is that this is equal to 2.5, and then people like to measure in the units of sun. So it's the luminosity of the sun divided by mass of the sun. So this would be the luminosity to mass ratio if you know, the required number of helium would be fused in stars in the history of the universe. So now, of course, you can compare this estimate to what is really observed. And what is observed is much, much smaller than luminosity, this ratio. So L over M perion is something like 0.05. Okay. So, 2.5 divided by 0.05. That means that less than 0.5% of the helium was fused in stars. Okay. So, you know, if you fused all the helium, all 25% of the abundance in the universe, then our sky would be really, really bright. Okay? Yeah, this is very rough estimate. So I was just saying, okay, so let's let the stars existed from the very beginning, and it's, you know, it's not that unreasonable. So, you know, galaxies start to form over there. Everything else happens very, very quickly, sort of, right? So it's, yeah, well, it's just an estimate. That's possible. That's possible. Well, it depends on how big the star is, right? So if you have big stars, they burn out very quickly. If you have small stars, they last very long. So yeah, that's possible. This is just a rough estimate, right? But I'm trying to convince you here that really you cannot fuse that much helium. At least it's inconsistent with the observation of how luminous the universe is. So maybe if it were much more luminous in the past, maybe. But you know, people don't really believe that. Yeah. Other questions? So we cannot fuse them in the stars, but we can fuse the helium after the Big Bang. So if there is hot Big Bang, then we can do that. But can do after Big Bang, in the first few moments after the Big Bang. Okay. So now let me really show you calculation of Gamow. Now, back of the envelope calculation. So, before we start calculating something, let me start at some huge temperature. So, let's say if we are 10 GeV. Then, you know, these are energies when all the usual particles, like electrons, protons, neutrons, whatever, they are relativistic. So usual particles are all relativistic. Basically, they are in thermal equilibrium, and that's why their number densities are all equal, and they are governed by the thing which we derived yesterday. So all n I equal to something d to the cube. And so all these things actually have the same number density. So now, as you decrease your temperature, of course, the most massive particles will suffer the most, right? So as long as you have equilibrium, then suddenly, if the particles are no longer relativistic, but they become non-relativistic, then you have the exponential factor which suppresses their number density. Okay, so now this happens for the protons and neutrons. This be, so below 1 GeV, which is the mass of the proton. So protons and neutrons become non-relativistic. That means that their number density is now governed by a different thing, which is this, whatever, mi t over 2 pi 3 halves, which is not that important, but the exponential thing is important, minus mi over t. So the number of neutrons and protons starts decreasing rapidly. Okay. But they are still sort of in equilibrium. So equilibrium, okay, so let me go all the way to MeV. So all the way up to MeV, everything is fine. Protons and neutrons are in equilibrium. Of course, the number of protons is different to number of neutrons because you have different mass of the proton and different mass of the neutron. Right, so they are not one to one anymore. So here they are one to one. Here they are not one to one anymore. But they are still in equilibrium. And this is basically true up to MeV. And so up to MeV, a thermal equilibrium and chemical equilibrium is maintained by reactions. You basically change neutrons to protons and so on. So you have proton, let's say, plus electron gives you neutron plus the neutrino, and you know cyclic permutations of these reactions. So for example, P plus goes to neutron plus neutrino plus positron and so on. So as long as these reactions actually go well, then this guy is true. However, at some temperature, these reactions do not go anymore. And then you say that, want to find the density of the neutrons with respect to the density of the protons when these reactions actually freeze out. When these now, to find out when these reactions actually freeze out, you see that the neutrinos actually enter these reactions. So these reactions are good only as long as neutrinos couple to the matter. Okay, so once the neutrinos completely decouple from the matter, these reactions stop going. Okay, so what you need to find out is basically when neutrinos decouple. When neutrinos decouple, these reactions cannot go anymore, and then we have result. Okay, so now you have reactions like electron, neutrino, and then you exchange W, and then you have electron and neutrino, something like that. So you have reactions like Ne, Ne, E plus, E minus, E, Ne. And so on. Okay. So now, if you want to calculate, so now we want to calculate again when these reactions sort of go away. So when these reactions go away, neutrino decouple from the rest of the matter. They decouple from electrons, but they also decouple from the protons. Basically, happens at the same temperature. So now, to see when this happens, is that you know that the amplitude of the of this diagram will be proportional to, so at each vertex you have the coupling G, okay, so this amplitude of the thing will be proportional to minus G square and the propagator of the exchange boson, which is the W in our case, so 1 over P square minus MW square, okay. So now W is very heavy, right? And so at these temperatures, at the temperatures of MeV or whatever, this thing will be small. So this approximately goes like G square over MW square. Okay. So what I'm doing now is basically I'm going from this type of diagram to the Fermi diagram. Okay. So what happens here? Okay, let me first write what it is. So this is the Fermi coupling constant, GF. And then what it is equal to, so this G square is 10 to minus 1. And then mass of W is 10 to the 2 GeV. Okay, so it's 1 over 10 to the 2 GeV square. So the Fermi coupling constant has units 10 to the minus 5. Okay. So what I'm really doing is I'm replacing this diagram with the diagram like that. Okay. And what stands here is the GF. Okay. Very good. So now, if you want to calculate the rate, we need the cross section. And the cross section, of course, is proportional to m square, right? So if you have the amplitude, then an amplitude square gives you something what is observable. Okay. So now, the rate of the interaction, just skipping all the stuff, is proportional to the cross section. It's proportional to gf squared. It's m square, right? Gf square. And now all the particles at these energies at MeV are still relativistic in this reaction. So that means that basically I can neglect all their masses, I can neglect all their chemical potentials, say, and the only energy I have is the temperature, the only quantity which has the units of energy, which can enter my rate here. So I just have to write down here T to some power so that I get whatever I need, right? And the power is T to the 5. So this thing is the approximate estimate for the rate of this reaction. And it's because everything is relativistic here. And I know that this thing, I must take m square, which is proportional to gf square. Okay, everybody happy with this estimate? It's basically a dimensional estimate. Okay. So we know what is the rate of the reaction of this reaction. So now we need to compare this to the Hubble expansion rate, right, to find out when this freezes out. So Hubble rate so if I'm writing down the Friedmann equation, you have h square equals to 8 pi g newton over 3 times rho minus k over a square. Okay, so that's my Friedmann's equation. Now, of course, you are in the early universe. This guy is zero now. It was even more zero in the early universe. So we just forget about this thing. Another thing is that in our units, where we keep only G Newton, basically the G Newton is given by 1 over m Planck square, and everything else is 1. So G Newton is 1 over m Planck square. And moreover, we are still in radiation-dominated era. Okay, so everything here is really radiation. So this energy density really corresponds to radiation. Okay, so what it is equal to is now 8 pi over 3. So now G Newton is m Planck square. And then for this rho, I'll put whatever we calculated yesterday. So it's p square 30. Then you have this g factor, which tells you how many degrees of freedom you have. And then it's t to the 4 m Planck square. Okay, so that's our Hubble rate. So that means that we have freeze out. By the way, so at this temperature, this G star, you know, when you calculate it, is approximately 10. So G star is just a number, just some 10. Okay. So freeze out is when gamma is equal to H. So gamma is gf square t to the 5. And this must be equal to, so this is h square. So I have to take square root of that. So it will be some number. And then it's t square over m Planck. OK. So now if you plug all the numbers, if you plug g star equal to 10, and then the rest is just pi's and something like that. So from here, you calculate that. This is true when actually the decoupling temperature is 1 MeV. Okay, so just from this very, very rough estimate, what we are doing here, you find that this is 1 MeV. So now if you do it accurately, and if you spend many, many days calculating this accurately, then you find that it's 0.8 MeV. So gives you zero t star equal 0.8 MeV. Very good. So this is the temperature at which actually neutrinos decouple from the matter. So we calculated from this reaction, which is actually more important reaction. But because they decoupled from electrons at approximately the same thing, they decoupled from those reactions for protons as well. So at this point, actually, this reaction ceases at temperature 0.8 MeV. So if we want to find out what is the ratio of number of neutrons and protons, we just use this thing here and plug there the temperature 0.8 MeV. Okay, so the number of neutrons, so at freeze out, the number of neutrons with respect to the number of protons. So now let's neglect that prefactor that is not very important. Let's just keep the exponential. So this is equal to e to minus q over t star. And this q is just the difference between the mass of the proton and the mass of the neutron. Right? That's what comes from there. So this is mass of the neutron minus mass of the proton, which is 1.3 MeV. Okay, so now if you plug it there, what you find is that number of neutrons over number of protons is 1 over 6. So for each neutron, you basically have 6 protons at this point at the freeze-out. So now, after the freeze-out, there is no thermal equilibrium anymore. So neutrons are separate, protons are separate, right? But fortunately or unfortunately for us, one of these particles is stable and the other one is not. So proton is stable and their number sort of remains the same, but neutrons decay. So they basically through the same reaction. So now, after freeze out, so they are independent, but neutrons are unstable. So their lifetime is something like 15 minutes. So tau in like 15 minutes. And they decouple to form more protons and electrons and neutrinos, but it's now only one way. It's not an equilibrium. They just simply decay e to minus t over tau. So depending on how long actually you wait, then that you don't get any neutrons after some time. Okay. So now if you want to fuse helium, you don't have much time. You have those 3 minutes actually. So within 3 minutes, you can have reasonable number of neutrons still. If you waited longer, or you know, if this was shorter, then you wouldn't see any helium. Okay. So what happens is actually that the number decreases, the ratio decreases, and when you actually started fusing helium, it was 1/7. So we calculate all this. So then all the neutrons are eaten by the helium. So now we know that helium is 2 neutrons plus 2 protons. So that's why the mass in helium will be, okay. So you have, well, protons and neutrons, they have approximately the same mass. This mass of the proton doesn't really matter at this point. So you have, this is the mass per one helium. And the number of helium you create is given by the number of neutrons which you have left divided by 2. Okay. Number of neutrons divided by 2. Well, it should be the number, not number density, but doesn't matter. Okay. So now if I want to calculate the ratio, is how much fraction of the mass you have in helium is how much you have in total. Okay. So the fraction, so eta is the fraction of nucleons mass that ends up in helium that helium, and that's given by this mass divided the total mass of the baryons. Okay, so this eta is given by, so now this thing is 2 MP and N, 2 MP and N, divided by the total thing, which is MP, and then number of NN plus number of NP. Okay, so that's the total mass. So this guy is the total mass in baryons. This guy is the total mass in helium. Okay, so now if you plug in the fraction 1 over 7 for NN over NP, what do you get? And just do it yourself. 1 plus 7, which is 1 over 4. So really, you can do 25% of helium. Okay. So now, it was all very rough, and as I said, you can do it much more accurately, but it basically gives you the idea that it's possible to do it in this way. So the result, of course, depends on many, many physical parameters. So it depends on the lifetime of the neutron. It depends on the mass of W, if you want. It depends on so many things. So once you start messing with these parameters, this thing actually changes. So this is a very precise test of your standard model, basically. And so similarly, if you look at the pictures I gave you, so first picture actually tells you a little bit more about this calculation, but the second picture is interesting. So there you see actually theoretical predictions for the abundance of helium and for the abundance of other things like lithium and deuterium and stuff like that. So if you look at that, in this graph, only one thing changes, one parameter changes. But depending on the value of that parameter, so as I said, there's many physical parameters which enter this calculation. But if you just mess with one, then the theoretical prediction of how much helium, how much deuterium, how much other things you have actually changes. So now this gray line like that, it tells you what is really measured. And then I see that it's not very light. So there is this, So it's teeny tiny. So there's these lines which you don't really see. I'll make another picture for you. So there are like small lines which are horizontal lines, which tells you what is actually the experimental thing, what is predicted by experiment. And then these very nice blue lines and green lines and red lines, so they are what is theoretically predicted depending on various parameters. And then you can see, not really, that for the helium, it exactly actually matches what is observed. For deuterium, it exactly matches. There is small discrepancy with lithium, so that's a puzzle. But you can really test by these predictions. You can test the Big Bang hypothesis, but you can also test the parameters of the standard model. Okay? So if you want to read more about these things, read Mukanov's book. Again, there's like a full calculation down there, so it's very, very long, but it's more accurate. And it's based on Boltzmann equation, and yeah. Okay, so let me finish here. So maybe one more joke to end up. Okay, so imagine somewhere in the Grand Prairie, there is a lonely tree, and on that tree, there is a crow, you know, sitting, enjoying herself, sunbathing on the sun. Suddenly, she starts hearing squeaky noises, and the tree starts shaking and trembling. So she looks down, and she sees a cow climbing up the tree. Okay, oh, stupid cow, why am I climbing this tree? Well, to eat the apples. Well, you are a stupid cow. This tree actually is a birch tree. There is no apples up here, right? I know. That's why I'm bringing them up with me. Okay. So this is the end of this lecture.